thank you to Hall & Wilcox for hosting. Thank you to JVD for organising and advertising. And thank you to all of you for attending. And I do see a lot of familiar, friendly faces, and that's lovely. And it's support for me as a woman. And I hope that everyone here will be able to go away with something and not just the Glick sandwich when it comes. All right, so the topic today, Jewish women in the boardroom, you'll see that, not for it to be a distraction, but I've put a handout as a reference aid, and it's just to assist with respect to some of the references we refer to. Jewish women in the boardroom throughout the ages, as it's been advertised, a walk through Tanakh and Talmud to glimpse women in leadership at the forefront of combat, business, education and strategic thought. And as lawyers, we are frequently heard to say it's all a matter of construction. Well, today I have taken the liberty to construe the boardroom to be defined as the greater boardroom, to mean any position of leadership within any capacity, whether it be women in corporate governance or women in elective office, women judges or women at the forefront of combat or academia, virtually any key position of leadership. And the topic was born in view of the backdrop of the underrepresentation of women in the boardroom in these key areas of leadership. And what I'd like to say to you from the outset is that from thinking about and researching this topic in preparation for today, I've come to the conclusion that irrespective of the Jewish or secular worlds, irrespective of the particular times that we live in, women have always been underrepresented in these key areas of leadership, and we still are today. However, notwithstanding that, there have been many powerful, wise, and dynamic women who have led the way in many of these key areas of leadership in both the Jewish and secular worlds throughout the ages. However, to a certain extent, I query if we have really progressed. Is what we have today really so much different than what we had in ancient times? So the fact that as I stand here before you in the 21st century in 2011, today in Australia we have female Prime Minister, female Premier, and female Governor General, that's great, and I say more power to women, but is it really all that different than this female representation we have seen in the past? And today, the purpose of this topic is to go back through the Jewish traditional historical texts and have a look at female representation in the boardroom and the greater boardroom, as I've defined it. And I put it to you that even as we look only at the Jewish texts, we will see quite a few examples of the female representation in the greater boardroom. So I'll leave that as something for you to ponder as we take this journey together. And we can discuss it later on, or you can take it away as food for thought. The other thing I say to you, and I note that there are some gentlemen in the room, and I thank you for coming, and I hope there'll be something for you to take away, is perhaps to turn our minds, and ladies, you can do that as well, to turn our minds to what was the perception of men then and now with respect to women in these key areas of leadership. And we'll see that a lot of the examples, most of the examples, it was the men who deferred to these women and said, we put you in these key areas of leadership. We want you there. We're asking for you to be the executives of the boardroom. What was the perception of men then and now? Has it changed, if any? So something else to keep in mind, those two key points as we take this journey together. Now, for the purposes of today, I don't intend to generally address issues of gender equality and the positive or negative qualities or characteristics of male-female dominance. I'm not here to advocate on behalf of women. I think the suffragette movement did a great job with respect to that. I must say that this morning and prior to today, I've received quite a number of calls and feedback from women who've seen the topic advertised, and they're like, hey, wow, great, you're there, and I'm feeling a bit like a suffrage, but I'm not, and I'm not here to advocate for gender equality. I think they did a great job then and continue to do so. Nor do I intend to debate the halakhic issues pertaining to Jewish women in today's modern world. I think to do them justice, they would need their own topics of discussion and their own lunch lectures. But what I am addressing today is the issue of gender diversity. The fact that as I stand here before you in 2011, despite the progression towards the equality of the sexes and our heightened sensitivity towards the issue, women are still underrepresented in the boardroom and the greater boardroom. Now, to put this in some context, for those of you who like statistics, in the US in 2000, the representation of women on Fortune 500 boards was 11.7%. A decade later, that number increased by 4 points to 15.7%, despite our heightened attention to the issue. To address the gap in representation, in the last several years, many countries have imposed or threatened to impose a quota in order to increase the representation of women to 20 to 40%, with particular focus on the representation of women in senior executive positions on the board level. Since we're in Australia, I'll just quickly take you through some of the Australian statistics. The Australian Bureau of Statistics, for 2010, chief executive officers in top 200 ASX companies, we have male to female percentage 97 to 3%, numbers 194 men to 6 women. That number, just by the way, has been very similar since 2002. So those statistics actually haven't really progressed in Australia in the last 8 years. As I've defined, the boardroom is the greater boardroom and not just limited it to corporate governance. If we look at Commonwealth judges and magistrates, 2011 statistics for this year, 108 males to 44 females, 71.1% to 28.9%. That's approximately a 7% increase since 2002. So some progression. Federal parliamentarians, 2011, 162 males to 64 females, 71.7% to 28.3%, approximately a 3% increase since 2001. So not a whole lot of progression, despite our heightened sensitivity, particularly in the last decade, with respect to this issue. Susan Anthony, 19th to 20th century, was a prominent American civil rights leader who played a pivotal role in the 19th century women's rights movement to introduce women's suffrage into the United States. I do not intend to compete with her today, but she says, "The day will come when men will recognise woman as his peer, not only at the fireside, but in councils of the nation. Then, and not until then, will there be the perfect comradeship, the ideal union between the sexes, that shall result in the highest development of the race." Well, I put it to you that we are still a long way away from that vision, despite our modern times and the sensitivity to gender equality and gender diversity. Women are still underrepresented in the boardroom in those key areas of leadership. But if we look back at some of our Jewish texts, as I said we would do, both Tanakhic and Talmudic, we can see that from the beginning of the ages, despite archaic times, Jewish women have held positions of leadership and have been at the forefront of combat, academia and education, law reform, business, strategic thought, where in many and most of those instances, it was the powerful and strong men of the time who deferred to the women for their advice and guidance. Harry Truman, 33rd US president, 1945 to 1953, once said, "There is nothing new in the world except the history you do not know." So perhaps nothing really has changed. And that's one of the things I've asked you to ponder. Perhaps the perception of gender diversity still remains the same, even as we stand here today. But at the very least, today we will be enlightened and enlivened to some of the historical Jewish female leaders who were prominent boardroom members from the beginning of time. Now, as we embark on this journey, the foundation I'd like us to sort of embark with comes from an article from Zvi Freeman, who's the author of Bringing Heaven Down to Earth, a work of Jewish philosophy. And I'll read it to you. "There is an outer Bible, a story of men and women, of wars and wonders. And there is an inner Bible, according to ancient traditions, in which each word uncovers fathomless wisdom, beauty and light. From the outside, the women of the Bible appear to play only a supportive role in a drama dominated by men. From the inside emerges a story of men manipulated by potent women and nurtured with feminine values, a story that reveals the inner quality of womanhood that transcends the minds of men. The inner light of womanhood is of an essence quality, of a place the mind cannot touch. This is the secret of the words of King Solomon. A woman of valour is the crown of her husband. As a crown is above the head and beyond it, so the inner light of womanhood is of an essence quality, of a place the mind cannot touch. Today we will only touch upon a few of these Jewish women who were leaders in their own way. We will explore some of the ancient Jewish texts of which I have provided a handout as a reference aid. Some of those women may be familiar to you, others may not. You will see that some have led in more overt ways, and some have been boardroom executives in more obscure, covert ways. But even those who have held leadership positions in what was seemingly behind the scenes, or in a more of a quiet manner, it was sometimes especially those women who were even more powerful and potent because they drew on the inner essence and quality of woman and translated that into whatever task was necessary, leaving a profound impact in their wake and earning the respect of their male counterparts. So if we look at the handout, we'll start off with the first reference. And I brought you an excerpt from Tractate Megillah, from Masechet Megillah, which is Talmud, where the Gemara cites seven prophetesses and their names, Sarah, Miriam, Devorah, Hannah, Abigail, Huldah, and Esther. And I brought this as the first reference because I think that whilst we won't touch on all of these seven prophetesses, they actually, a few of them, fall very nicely within the categories of key areas of leadership that I've defined within the greater boardroom. And not just because they're prophetesses, but they fall under some of these other key areas. So if we look at reference number 2, Bereshit Kaf Alef Yud Bet, Genesis 21:12, God says to Abraham, Kol Asher Tomar Elecha Sarah Shma B'Kola, do everything that Sarah tells you. We can't help but start with our matriarch, Sarah. She's the wife of the first Jew, Abraham, who was a prophet as well. She, a prophetess, as we see from reference number 1 of Tractate Megillah. And what does God say to this male prophet who's the father of the Jewish nation? Whatever Sarah tells you, listen to her. And the commentator Rashi tells us that Sarah's level of prophecy far surpassed that of Abraham. And that's why God said to Abraham, you're great, but your wife is even greater. And he brought the lesson home to Abraham that his wife was the CEO, the CFO, the COO of her boardroom. And as our first matriarch, Sarah passes this quality on to all of us. So it really very much sets the foundational premise for the other Jewish women that follow. The next woman we move on to is Miriam. Miriam is also one of the seven prophetesses that are listed in reference 1. But Miriam is more than just a prophetess. She's a leader of the Jewish women in Egypt during the times of slavery. And her mother Yocheved were actually midwives, and they were very instrumental in keeping the spirit and the morale alive during those very dark days. And it is because they made executive, proactive decisions to keep the morale and spirit alive, to inspire hope and light and the belief that they would be redeemed one day, that Miriam merits to lead the nation out in song at the time of the redemption and the splitting of the Reed Sea. And we see reference 3, Shmot Tedvav Chaf, Exodus 15:20, Vatikach Miriam Hanaviah Achot Aharon Et Atof Biada. Miriam, the prophetess, as we've mentioned, she is, Aaron's sister, took the drum in her hand, and the women followed her with drums and dancing. So again, we see here a woman who was proactive, who was an executive leader, who made decisions in very dark and hard times to lead her people with hope and with strength. Okay, the next reference I'll take you to does not follow the sequence in terms of the seven prophetesses that Tractate Megillah has listed, but it falls nicely into another category of leadership, which I've coined law reform. And it's the law of inheritance of land, the law of inheritance that in the past, traditionally, was passed on from father to son. And we see there are the daughters of Tzlafchad, five daughters. Their names are Mahla, Noah, Chagla, Milcah, and Tirzah. And the story that we have is we're in the desert and Moses is dividing the land in preparation for the entrance into Eretz Yisrael, and these five daughters come before Moses, before Eleazar the priest, before the princes, before the entire community, quite radical, and they challenge a law that has been there all the time. And they say, Moses, we are five daughters. Our father died in the desert. He left no son. But why should his name and land be disadvantaged and not passed on because he has no son? Let it pass on to us as his daughters. So the first thing is that we see these five women taking a very proactive stand to affect change, to affect law reform, to challenge what was the accepted norm. The second thing which is interesting is that Moses, the leader of the Jewish nation, the great Moses, takes this claim before God. So the man, the great man in the story, recognizes the importance of the claim, recognizes these great women who are affecting change, and takes the claim to God. And what happens when he takes the claim to God? That's reference number four. God says, "Ken benot slavcha dovrot naton titen lahem achuzat nachala betocha chayavihem va'avarta et nachalat avihem lahem." The daughters of Tzlafchad have a just claim. Give them a hereditary portion of land alongside their father's brothers. Let their father's hereditary property thus pass over to them. So God accepts their claim. And not only do they affect the change for themselves, that their father's land will now be passed on to them, even though they are daughters, God continues to say to Moses, now instruct the people about the new law. And what's the new law? Reference 5. Ish ki yamut uven en lo, v'havartem et nachalato lebito. Speak to the Israelites and tell them that if a man dies and he has no son, his hereditary property shall pass over to his daughter. And this is what we've just seen. V'im en lo bat unetatem et nachalato le'echav. If he has no daughter, then his hereditary property shall be given to his brothers. V'im en lo achim unetatem et nachalato le'achay aviv. If he has no brothers, you shall give his property to his father's brothers. And it goes on. And it ends and says, this was the decreed law for the Israelites as God had commanded Moses. An entire new law was enacted as a result of these five proactive women who, despite that radical notion of coming forward and challenging something that was wholly accepted, they managed to affect change, to affect law reform. And if you go on to over the page to reference 6, just to end the story, what actually happens when they get to Eretz Yisrael, we have an excerpt out of the prophets, Joshua 17:3-4, Yoshua Yudzayin Gimel to Dalid. I won't read out the full text, but if you just look at the last line, Vayiten lahem el pi Hashem nachala b'tocha chayavihen, when they're actually in the Holy Land and the land is now being given out, we see this new law being applied. And what does it say? And he gave them, Joshua gave them, according to the word of Hashem, a heritage among their father's brothers. The daughters got the land. So what was enacted then was applied now. Leaders of law reform, leaders and senior executives of their bordering. Okay, moving along, we come to our next individual. And also a prophetess mentioned in reference 1, Tractate Megillah, Devorah. Devorah, a female judge. Now, I've read out to you earlier the statistics with respect to the judges. We see that female judges are still only a small percentage with respect to the male-female ratio. It's a small percentage with respect to that. But here we have a female judge. Back in our archaic times, during the times of the judges, Shoftim Dalit, Dalit Techet, we're at reference 7, Judges 4:4-8. Udevora Isha Nivia Eshet Lapidot Ishaftat Yisrael Ba'etahi. Devorah was a prophetess, as we know, the wife of Lapidot. She judged Israel at that time. Now it's interesting because some leadership literature that I have come across tells us that the best leaders have a time in the wilderness, and it is this that makes them stronger. obviously we can interpret that as we want, but interestingly, and there are reasons for this which we won't go into today, if you look at the next verse, V'hi yoshevet tachat tomer devora, ben harama uven betkel, bahar Ephraim, ba'alu eleha, b'nei Yisrael amishvat. She would sit under the date palm of Devora, between the Ramah and Betkel on Mount Ephraim, and the children of Israel would go up to her for judgment. So interestingly, Devora actually sits literally in the wilderness under a palm tree and judges the people. And all of the nation at that time, during that period, come to her for her guidance and counsel. Now, at the time that she's judging the nation, the Jews are being oppressed by foreign powers, and one of them is the Canaanite king and his army. And they're about to wage battle with the Canaanite king, Yavin, and the head of his army, who was Sisera. And Barak ben Avinoam, who is a mighty warrior at the time, comes to Devorah and says, if we look at reference 8, Vayomer eleha Barak, im telchi imi bahalachti, v'im lo telchi imi lo elech. Barak said to her, if you go with me, I will go, but if you do not go, I will not go. So this mighty male warrior, as they're about to wage war with the foreign power, the Canaanite king Yavin, and the head of his army, Sisera, and the massive army, comes to Devorah, the female judge, and says, I'll go to war, but only if you come with me. And what he basically does is he says to her, I want you to be my battalion leader. I want you to be there at the front lines, and probably also with respect to an intelligence sort of position as well. I want you to come with me to war, and only if you come with me to war will I go. And according to the commentator, the Ralbag, he felt that in her merit, God would bring the downfall to the Canaanite army and the victory to the Jewish army. And that's why he said this in no uncertain terms. I've come across a quote by Philip Armour, 19th century, an American businessman who founded Armour & Company, an American meatpacking firm, from his earnings on the Californian goldfields. And he says, no general can fight his battles alone. He must depend upon his lieutenants, and his success depends upon his ability to select the right man for the right place. And I say, to select the right woman for the right place. Barak knew this. He came and he said, she's my woman. She's going to be the head of my boardroom here at the forefront of combat, at the forefront of the battle, and it is with her that we will win the war. And interestingly, going back a little bit, God does this in a certain sense when we became the Jewish nation at Mount Sinai. At the time that he's giving the Bible, he says to Moses, Kotamar levet Yaakov v'taged l'bnei Israel. Go tell the women first. Bet Yaakov alludes to the women, b'nei Israel alludes to the men. Go tell the daughters of Yaakov, daughters of Jacob, tell them about the Torah. And then, v'taged l'bnei Israel, then tell the sons of Israel. Go to the women first, then go to the men. God's saying, I want female representation in my boardroom. I want this responsible leadership. I know that I will be successful, that my will be followed if you go to the women first. Now, what happened, back to the story of Devorah. Devorah agreed to go. The war was won through the hands of a woman. Devorah was at the war, but the war was actually won through the hands of another woman, Yael, the wife of Chever HaKeni. And when the war came to an end, Devorah sings a song of praise to God. And reference 9 is reference to that, is an excerpt from the song of praise. And it's set out like that because in the text, it's actually set out like verses of a song, of a poem. And one of the things that Devorah says in this song of praise is, she says, you know, Israel had certain circumstances, but then when I came along, others, you know, their situation improved or whatever. And she says, the way she says it is, she says, Ad shekamti Devorah, until Devorah arose, shekamti em b'Israel, I arose as a mother in Israel. So at the end of the war, after Devorah has been very much involved in what we would, you know, traditionally or colloquially look at as quite male sort of role, both in her judgment, both in her and in her, you know, going out to war and being at the forefront of combat, she sings this praise and she refers to herself as an Em B'Yisrael, as a mother in Israel. She doesn't refer to herself as the great judge, as the combat leader. She refers to herself as the mother in Israel, very much tuning in to her feminine characteristics, which goes back to what we initially, that foundational premise I read out to you about the inner essence qualities of woman. She's very much tuning into that while she's doing what she needs to do, being the judge, fighting at the forefront of battle, winning the war. She remembers that she is a woman, and it is these special qualities that she is bringing to the boardroom to nurture her nation with kindness and with faith. And that's why she says a mother in Israel. Okay. Now, the last text that I'm taking you to is also one of our seven prophetesses. It's the last one mentioned in reference number one of Tractate Megillah, Esther. Esther is one of my favourite. Esther, her very name, Seter, means hidden. The root of her name means hidden. So I like to think of her as the covert operative, the undercover CIA agent. Again, a leader, but in a more covert way. Esther is the queen of Persia. She's queen to the king of Ahasuerus. She's queen at a very difficult time, when the wicked Haman decrees that the Jewish people are going to be destroyed and annihilated. And Mordechai, the Jewish leader at the time, says to Esther, it is you that is going to save the day. Once again, we see the man deferring to the woman and saying, it's up to you. We're dead without you. And we see that Esther, with her quiet skills of negotiation, with her quiet skills of strategy, in that covert way, manages to affect the salvation of the Jewish people. And she says to Mordechai, gather the people, fast for me, myself and my maidens will fast too, and then I will go to the king. And the significance of going to the king on the third day of fasting is that the usual course was you could not go to the king unless you were summoned, and if you did, you would be killed. If you went without being summoned, you would be killed. The reference 10 out of Megillat Esther, this is out of Ketuvim, the writings, 5:1-3. I won't read out the whole text, but Vayehi bayom ha-shlishi vatilbash Esther malchut vatamod b'chatzar bet ha-melech ha-plimit. It came to pass on the third day, Esther donned royalty and stood in the inner court of the king's palace. She went without being summoned. She risked her life, but this is what she had to do as leader and executive of her boardroom. Margaret Thatcher, the former UK Prime Minister, quotes, if you want anything said, ask a man. If you want something done, ask a woman. Mordechai knew this. Just like Barak, Mordechai understood that he needed to select the right woman for the right place, and he did just so. And her powers and her skills and her executive decisions in her boardroom as a key leader, both a prophetess, a queen, a covert operative, save the day. And the Jewish people are here today as a result. Did you want a break? Or is the lunch here?
Maybe just ask everybody if they want.
How are you doing with lunch feelings?
Are we happy to continue? Okay, cool.
Thank you. So once again, we see another great leader. And I'll just take you through a few examples that I don't have textual references for, but also to just show you through both Talmudic and the times of Gaonim, Rishonim, Achronim, until the most recent centuries, women who stood at the forefront and were leaders in both the worlds of academia and the worlds of business. We have Bruya, the daughter of Rabbi Hanina ben Tarajon, the wife of Rabbi Meir, who was a great academic, whose views on halachic matters were accepted as doctrine. According to Tractate Pesachim, she studied 300 laws from 300 teachers in one day. It's a lot. I don't think I even get master one law. So one example of someone brilliant that's quoted in Talmud. Some other interesting examples. We've mentioned the commentator Rashi, the great commentator. He was a scholar of medieval Ashkenazic Jewry during the 12th century. All of his daughters were scholars, academics, well-versed in scripture and Jewish law. And in later years, when sickness prevented him from compiling his own commentaries, he actually deferred to his daughters and they compiled his commentaries for him. During the 16th century, the daughter of Reb Shmuel of Kurdistan, later known as Rabbanit Mizrahi, was well known for her scholarly ability. In her youth, she listened to the classes in Talmud given to the boys in her father's yeshiva. As a young woman, she assumed a teaching position in the Talmudic Academy and soon found herself surrounded by students of all ages who again deferred to her for halakhic decisions. Once again, these men recognising the leadership of these women and looking to them for success. She ultimately became a full-time teacher in the yeshiva founded by her husband and assumed the fundraising function and business management, so proving also to be quite a successful businesswoman. Also in the 16th century, we have Bela Folk of Lemberg. She was one of the noteworthy female halachas at the time. She was married to Rabbi Yoshua Folk, a leading member of the Council of the Four Lands and author of the book Mi'irate Naim and another book, Derisha or Prisha. Her original commentaries were exceptional and her knowledge of Jewish law was equal to that of the great rabbis of her generation. One of her most noteworthy halachic contributions, as actually codified in the Code of Jewish Law in the Shulchan Aruch itself, concerns the Yom Tov candles, where she said, and she opined that on festivals, the blessing should be said before the candles are lit, which obviously is reversed on the Sabbath. 16th to 17th century, we have Chava, the granddaughter of the Maharal of Prague. She was a scholar of considerable intellectual attainment. It is said that she knew the entire Mishnah by heart. Her opinions were sought on obscure passages which had baffled competent scholars, again, men deferring to her for her rulings. She would often engage her father's students in debates as to correct halakhic rulings. She wrote her own original commentary on the Midrash, and her father drew on her expertise, again, her dad deferring to her, in his compilation of his commentary Matnot Kuhuna on the Midrash. At the age of 24, and this is unbelievable because I think, wow, what did I do at 24? She compiled a commentary on the Machzor, the liturgy for the high holidays. So some of you maybe will have a look at that now as we approach this time of year. Rabbi Moshe Ashkenazi of Posen, Poland, author of Zichron Moshe on Rashi, was married to a successful businesswoman and generous philanthropist. She served as the Duke's chief financial advisor and manager. So there you go, CFO, right in the boardroom. She arranged for the construction of a huge state-of-the-art building to serve as the synagogue and yeshiva in her city. She maintained both of these institutions for over 20 years and single-handedly supported the scholars who studied there and funded the printing of their innovative Torah interpretations. This is an interesting one. In the 18th century, Kreindl Steinhardt, known as D. Rebbetzin, was an expert in Bible and Medrash. She encouraged her husband, Rabbi Yosef ben Menachem, to publish his work on the Torah called Zichron Yosef. Yosef often quotes the commentaries of his learned wife. This was quite well known. So a number of his contemporaries said to him, Yosef, why are you calling it Zichron Yosef? Call it Zichron Kreindl. I don't know if he ever changed the name, but good point. Finally, in the 19th century, another example, we have Charlotte Rothschild, the daughter of Shimon and Adele. She was known to be a great philanthropist and businesswoman of her time. She was involved in many not-for-profit causes and organisations, and some of her not-for-profit work included funding weddings for poor brides and founding a school for needy Jewish girls in London. She also made many literary contributions, so again, someone who was both involved in the worlds of academia and business. And in conclusion, these are just a small collection of the examples of Jewish women who throughout the ages refer to in scripture, including Torah, Nevi'im, the prophets, Ketuvim, the writings, and I've taken you through only some of them, Talmudic times and the ages of the Gaonim, the Rishonim, and the Achronim, up until the recent centuries and the contemporary modern times, who have led the way in the boardroom and the greater boardroom in many different capacities. As women today in the 21st century, we can take strength from our predecessors and be leaders of our times, bringing our unique feminine qualities to the forefront of the legal world. the business world, the political world, and the world of academia. And just to leave off with a quote from a recent journal article on business ethics. And I quote, "What are the boards missing? They are missing the opinion of the persons who represent 70% of all purchasing decisions in the household. They are missing the perspective of the one group who can give them a more competitive viewpoint in the marketplace. And they are missing the maturity of women who are already the CEO, the CFO, and the COO of their own household." Thank you all for attending and wishing you and your families a Shana Tova and a healthy and happy sweet new year. And now I open it up, well, for lunch first and for discussion on those two points that I've asked you to keep in mind if you'd like to. That is, whether things have really changed. Are our times so different in terms of female representation in the boardroom and the greater boardroom? And what are the perspectives and what were the perspectives of men then and now, if that's something you'd like to discuss? Thank you.
Thanks, Rizky. Maybe I'd invite you all to take something to eat, and if you'd like, you can sit down and then we can have that discussion over some sandwiches, if that suits.
Thanks.
Someone lead the way.
Don't be shy. Thanks. Right, thanks, Eric. Yeah. But I was glad because I knew David told me he was speaking to you.
I'm so sorry, my name's Leah.
So he told me that he was speaking to him, that you said he was speaking to him, and that you had actually met him. So I knew what he said to that. I'm so glad you were
actually funny. But I said to him, I said, we only had 2 seconds going down
and looking
about
the futility of life. I know. I walked around the whole
thing.
We felt
that. Oh, that's right, the view was. It was interesting, the cafe.
Yes, that's right. I remember that.
Am I in the right place?
Oh, is that still on? Is it still on?
Yeah. I'll let you leave.